Merci à Safia Nolin. On va mettre tous les liens aussi vers ses projets en cours dans les notes de l'épisode. Safia participe d'ailleurs au Cabaret Mes Poils du 31 mai, qui se tient cette année sur Facebook à 20h le 31 mai. Manquez pas ça.
Venez célébrer ma fête dans ce cabaret-là, j'ai oublié de vous
c'est
dire.
C'est le 31, ta fête?
C'est le 31. C'est ma fête. Allez. Au Cabaret Mes Poils. Soyez là pour moi, juste pour moi. OK.
Soyez à la fête à Laurie. Merci Laurie Perron et François Forcier pour la musique. Merci à Audrey Laperrière pour notre visuel. Merci à Marie-Ève Boisvert pour le montage. Merci à vous d'avoir joué avec nous. On se retrouve bientôt pour un nouvel épisode de Tout ou Pantoute.
Good evening, friends and comrades. Welcome back to Amandla Radio here at CQT 90.3 FM Montreal. And tonight we have what, Gwen, on our agenda?
Well, actually, we are devoting the entire hour to commemorating the Rabaa massacre in Egypt, which occurred on August 14th, 2013, when the army stormed the encampment in Rabaa Square and killed more than 1,000 peaceful protesters. So today, we'll be reflecting on this and commemorating it, a very dark turning point during the Arab Spring, with interviews with three guests: Mohammed Dawood, a film producer who was present that day and is now putting the finishing touches on a documentary about it; Mohammed Sharif Kamel, who is an activist, political analyst, and member of the Egyptian-Canadian Coalition for Democracy; and Asma Ali Hussein, who was with her husband Amr and her toddler visiting family in Alexandria when her husband, who joined a peaceful protest against the Rabaa massacre, was killed. So the whole hour, we'll be listening to their voices, all insightful, all bringing their own experiences and thoughts about a very, very dark day and moment. So please stay tuned to Amandla here on CQUT 90.3 FM.
Dear listeners, you're tuned to CKUT 90.3 FM on the dial or www.ckut.ca on the internet. Today we present a special commemoration edition for the Rabaa massacre that took place in Rabaa Square, Egypt, August 14, 2013. To put things in context, let's go back to January 25, 2011, Tahrir Square, the epicenter of the protests against then Hosni Mubarak. The winds of the Arab Spring that started in Tunisia were now blowing all over Egypt, and Saudis were demanding bread, liberty, social justice. Ultimately, Mubarak resigned, and subsequently, the late Mohamed Morsi was elected president in June 2012. However, exactly 1 year later, Morsi was forcibly removed from office in a military coup orchestrated by the army under then General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Over the course of the following 2 months, Mohamed Morsi's supporters, mainly but not exclusively from the Muslim Brotherhood Party, organized two large sit-ins in Cairo and smaller protests across Egypt to denounce the military takeover and demand the reinstatement of President Morsi. In response, police and army forces repeatedly opened fire on demonstrators, killing over 1,000, most of them in 5 separate incidents of mass protester killings. The Human Rights Watch 1-year investigation into the conduct of security forces in responding to these demonstrations indicates that police and army forces systematically and intentionally used excessive lethal force in their policing, resulting in killings of protesters on a scale unprecedented in Egypt. The evidence Human Rights Watch examined includes on-site investigations at each of the protest sites during or immediately after the attacks were underway, interviews with over 200 witnesses, including protesters, doctors, journalists, and local residents, and review of physical evidence, hours of video footage, and statements by public officials. On this basis, Human Rights Watch concluded that the killings not only constituted serious violations of international human rights law, but likely amounted to crimes against humanity. Given both their widespread and systemic nature and the evidence suggesting the killings were part of a policy to attack unarmed persons on political grounds. While there's also evidence that some protesters use firearms during several of these demonstrations, Human Rights Watch was able to confirm their use in only a few instances, which do not justify the grossly disproportionate and premeditated lethal attacks on overwhelmingly peaceful protesters. To honor the victims of the Rabaa massacre, those who lost their lives to defend the dream of living in a democratic society, Mohammed Dawood is putting the finishing touches on a documentary recounting the horror of that day, August 14, 2013. Mohammed Dawood, welcome to our program and thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations. I have assisted to the preview of your documentary and wish to congratulate you sincerely for your courage. It is heartbreaking to watch this tragedy for 1 hour, and you've been working on this documentary for a few years now. I have to tell you, yesterday I had nightmares just after reading the facts for this interview. Tell us, what keeps you going?
Yes, thank you, Sama, and I appreciate all the efforts you guys are doing. Special thanks to CKUT Radio. The question is, for me, what keeps me going is the fact that I took an oath to myself, leaving those events, that I will one day bring justice back to those who were victims. Seeing those things unfolding in front of your eyes is so different from watching TV or listening to news.
So you were there at Rabaa?
Yes, I was. Okay. And actually, a lot of my a lot of the content I'm showing in the documentary is either filmed by myself or solicited from a friend who were filming with me. What keeps me going aside from this oath is that the feeling that we all had after the January 25th, 2011 revolution, that clock will not go back, and the intrinsic change inside everyone in the Middle East, but especially Egyptians, promises a lot of development, and promises us that injustice won't be tolerated anymore. So we keep going, holding this promise, buried under a lot of traumas and a lot of pains. But we know that one day we will bring justice back.
We heard the sound trailer. Are these real voices? The sound that where we hear the men speaking over the loudspeakers and saying you have to disperse now, and this is an order from the Attorney General.
Yes. So this is an iconic soundtrack that everyone who remembers Rabah or have been to Rabah or reported about Rabah remember hearing. These were sirens and PA announcements that started with the beginning of the day at 6 a.m. On August 14th, 2013, the day the government decided to disperse Rabah at all costs, and APC and government security forces ascended on Rabah to disperse it using absolute force. And then they played this to basically record it on cameras and audio record it to prove a truth that they were trying this under the shades of law, and they gave people the chance to escape. The actual truth on the other hand was that these were played while people are being attacked and killed before they even think of what those announcements were meant to be and what the reactions should be. So people got shocked by the amount of smoke and tear gas thrown at them, and then rubber bullets and then live bullets at 6 a.m. in the morning while those were playing.
Just to put it in context, we know that although the voices, over the loudspeakers, they said that you can disperse peacefully, there was no exit, and they were firing on those who were at Rabah.
So basically, there were some passages that people could hide and try to avoid sniper bullets to try to escape, but they were very limited, and people didn't know about them. Unless other people were scouting and they come back saying, okay, guys, there's this passage that if you want to try, it mainly were made for the priorities, like women and children to escape Rabah. And those weren't made under the eyes of the government. The government made sure to block every certain passage away from, leading and channeling people from Rabah. But those passages were basically the alleyways between apartments, and they had to be scouted first to know that they are safe. Only people had to duck from snipers to try to avoid when they were fleeing. But basically, we stayed in Rabah trapped between the smoke and firing and all of that for 10 hours. Telecom services weren't working. No one had signals because for some reason, either the government we didn't hear of any official news about it, but either there was some intentional blocking, or there could be a chance that everyone was overwhelming the networks, since thousands of people were there, and I would assume a lot of families were trying to reach them to check on them, to to flee, and it was so hard to communicate with the outside world.
Yeah.
So we stayed there for 10 hours until certain passages started to clear out.
Actually, I was reading from the human rights report that were about 85,000 people encamped in Rabah. So that's just to show the magnitude of the protest. And in your documentary, you feature a diversity of people. How did you choose them?
So when we started, we reached out to all the people we know in Canada. So Akram, the producer of this work, he was on board from the beginning, and Mustafa, who's also a co-producer. Both of them lived in Canada more than I did. So they knew some people who were there. So we started asking around. So basically, mostly relying on word of mouth, meeting people and networking and getting hearing their stories. So doing almost like pre-interview scouting. So talking to them over the phone, asking if they knew someone else, because most probably people who were in Rabah and they were visiting Egypt from other countries, they mostly stuck together. So there were certain tents and certain activities that gathered people coming from abroad. So they knew each other already. So when they came back to Canada, they already had some connection in Rabah, and they were able to identify, so help us identify others.
I know that I'm not allowed to give specifics, but it was so moving to see one of them, one of the former prisoners, talking about his experience while he was detained during the events, because he was filming the dead and how he was treated in prison, how his Canadian passport didn't help him. I'm saying this because I remember the mobilization of demonstrations in front of the Egyptian consulate here in Montreal, and these thousands of papers, letters, petitions that we presented to the council. So this shows one thing. It shows that civil society can be effective and that every voice counts. So I'm very pleased that you have brought in this Canadian dimension, so that here in Canada we also be sensitized to the issue that it's not happening in a faraway places. And even if it's in a faraway place, we should be concerned as Canadians.
Of course, yes. We named it Canadians of Rabah for a reason. So despite the fact that there were a lot of other victims internationally and in many other countries, that the tragedy transcended borders, really. But we wanted the experience to be like, basically the access we had was in Canada, and we knew that there was a lot of stories in Canada, so we wanted to focus on that perspective. And the story you were talking about is John Grayson's, and it was well known in the news back then. But there were multiple other stories for Canadians who happened to visit Egypt around or after the events, and they were prosecuted. There were major campaigns for those people to force the government to release them, one of which were pre-Khaled campaign. That launched right after the tragedy, like right after the coup in Egypt, when he was detained with other politicians and public figures in Egypt. And finally, after a few years, they managed to release him. But John specifically had a very unique perspective, since he actually didn't have any attachments to Egypt. He wasn't going there to visit family. He didn't have any Egyptian background, but he was there to basically using Egypt as a stop to go to Gaza and document relief work happening in Palestine. And then things happened to be unfolding while he's on the plane. And he landed in, as he described, an utter turmoil, trying to figure out how to go to Gaza, but couldn't because the curfew was prevalent. And then you know, everything started unfolding, and he found himself within protests, and then found himself being prosecuted and beaten and tortured. And he has amazing, amazing stories from inside the prisons about how the perseverance of people, the perseverance of Egyptian prisoners, and how they formed almost a community inside the prison to survive and rely on each other. We didn't have enough time to show all these stories, but we are intending to have some extras coming after following the documentary to show some of those amazing stories on their own.
In fact, Mohammed Daoud, after the screening, men from the audience came up to you. They seemed to be very emotional. What were they talking about?
Some of them were expressing how this put them back to the sad times, and some expressed the feeling of how they were trying to forget about this and move on in their lives. To be honest, this is a cause of trauma to a lot of Egyptians. We try to move on as a community, and the people who are concerned about the cause, as much as they are still concerned to help the prisoners and to help the human rights violations happening in Egypt and to shed light on that, they somehow, as human beings, we try to put a bandage on our trauma and move forward. So having such a work brings back all those memories. But people appreciated the fact that we are still remembering the victims. We're not moving away from trauma and at the same time moving away from bringing people to justice. These shouldn't be tied together. We should still remember the victims. We should still remember that people are not brought to justice, who are the perpetrator of the tragedy. So a work like this is a mix between hope and trauma that people are trying to process. And these are basically the comments, the context of the comments I received after.
We don't have much time left, Mohammed Daoud, but let me ask you, you mentioned that you still have to polish the documentary. It's not finished yet. So what else were you planning to do?
We put this together quickly to catch this anniversary, because we have been promising the community to come out. There are still very little work to be done, like coloring, sound mixing, a few stories, structure changes, and then licensing and paperwork, logistic stuff needs to be done.
Thank you very much, Mohammed. We were in conversation with Mohammed Daoud, producer of the documentary Canadians for Rabah. When we come back, we look at the political aspects of the massacre of Rabah Square. Please stay with us. You're listening to CKUT, and this is a special program to commemorate the victims of Rabah Square, who lost their lives defending the ideals of democracy following the Arab Spring of 2011.
تفضل اعتصام تتم بقرار من النيابة العامة وبحضور وسائل الإعلام والمنظمات الحقوقية والمجتمع المدني. قوات الأمن تناشد سكان المنطقة بإغلاق جميع الشرفات والنوافذ والالتزام بالتوازن داخل المنازل أثناء فض الاعتصام. تفضل اعتصام تتم بقرار من النيابة العامة
For listeners who just joined us on CKUT 90.3 FM on the dial, this was a clip from the documentary Canadians for Rabah. We are now joined by Mohamed Kamel, well-known activist and political analyst. Mohamed Kamel, welcome to our program and thank you so much for being with us. You heard what was said over the loudspeakers. If we translate, you have to disperse. This is an order from the Attorney General. So if we want to live in a country where the law is respected, we have to abide by the laws. What are your comments?
Actually, it's very sad that the concept of the law being used in a crime. Yes, we have to live in a country, and all of us have to abide by the law. But all of us have to abide by the same law that apply to everyone on every minute and in every action. But what happened is using the law to commit a crime. And I might be biased, and people might say that this person is biased. That's okay, acceptable. But what about Human Rights Watch report that indicates very clearly that it was a planned action to kill the maximum possible of the people on the peaceful city, on the two square in Rabaa in Cairo and in Al-Mahda on the suburb, to kill those people intentionally. And it is really being described as a massacre and being described as the worst massacre in the modern history committed by the government against its own people, against the people who's peacefully sitting in rejecting a military coup. So I don't understand the way that the Egyptian authority at that time and until today tried to use the word law and abide by law in a crime committed against any law. Number one, coup is a crime, is not by the law. Number two, just moving and killing all those people and injured, killing at least 1,000-something. The report from Human Rights Watch count for 860, I think, if I remember the number correct, intentionally. So what else could be used to justify illegitimate action under the law name? So I think there is no law on the earth can justify something.
I'm glad you're mentioning the report of Human Rights Watch because actually it gives a lot of details. And if we think about the media and how it was presented at that time, I'm quoting here, during the dispersal, journalists covering the event were trapped. Four of them were killed while others were injured or detained. And according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, it was the deadliest day for journalists in Egypt since the organization began keeping records in 1992. What do you have to tell us about the media in Egypt from Rabaa to the present day?
It added insult to the energy. You know, you're killing people, I'm meaning the authority, the Egyptian authority, killing people, and killing reporters who would like to report the facts on the ground. So that means you try to kill, you try to not leave any evidence behind you because you, the Egyptian authority, know that you are committing crime against every in law, even if the Egyptian law itself. So killing journalists, it's an additional crime on its own. And we know that journalists, and from the reports, and from the reports of all organizations and civil society, that journalists, and for sure, some of the demonstrator being targeted, just not killing by mistake, not killing by fire, not killing by, being targeted. There was snipers on the top of the building, and it is clear, and being all international media took a footage of it. There was a sniper on the top of the building targeting specific people from the demonstrator and from the journalist as well. So, as I said, it's adding insult to say that, and the clip on the beginning when they tried to announce that they're going to disperse the sick, and they said that journalists are here to report. So for sure, who reported are their propaganda journalists who've been allowed to take photos of what they would like to take, which is none of them even give any proof that this was a legitimate and coordinated, not heavy-handed operation, but to the opposite. It is really targeting, killing, and killing with pre-intention to do so.
Now, to be fair, we have to mention that el-Sisi is calling for a national dialogue at the moment. Tell us about this dialogue.
Dialogue is important in every country life. And usually when you cross the point where you have a problem, you have to start to talk to people. And dialogue are there when there is no parliament. And we know in Egypt there is something called parliament to be elected. But it's not elected, and it does not represent people. Yes, some people went to poll, and yes, there was election, but it was not election because only listed people have the right to run for this election. Not anybody can go. And then became a parliament that handicapped, cannot do anything, cannot help anything, cannot question government. Government is above accountability. There's no transparency. Government is being directed directly by Sisi, who is the absolute dictator of Egypt today, since 2013, 2014, until today. And now Egypt has a crisis, and really a big economical crisis. Forget the political crisis. Forget that there is no freedom. Forget dictatorship. Forget there is no freedom of expression, no democracy. No, forget all the stuff. There is a real crisis in Egypt on economical, and no one can claim this to the war in Ukraine, because this is been going on since the military coup until today, day after day after day, just being deteriorated, the situation right now with the international economic situation. But because Egypt didn't really reach a point that it borrowed money from the International Monetary Fund and from the International Bank, they borrowed money to use for unnecessary, and every media, international media, reported this. Just the Financial Post just yesterday, there was a big article about this. The Foreign Policy, not the Financial Post. I'm sorry, just the FPD confused me. The Foreign Policy has an article, clear article about this, that Egypt authority borrowing money and put it in unessential stuff. There is no economical development at all in Egypt. There is very big gap between all category of Egyptian. There's the low-income people became the majority. They cannot even survive. And now he's calling for national dialogue limited to the people who support him. So it became even another joke that what dialogue? You chat with who? You're discussing with who? Who is there on the table to discuss is only the people you select to sit at the table to do something. And unfortunately, what Egypt started to do to be able to pay back the debt in the internationally, forget that the local debt. The local debt is not going to be paid back for people to people. Internationally, they start to sell the Egyptian assets. And even there is a talk today about selling the Suez Canal. And they sold already a lot of manufacturing and a lot of company, a lot of organization that are really a production who are really helping the Egyptian people to survive and the development. So now this dialogue is really to justify the selling of Egyptian assets. Only he's talking to himself. So I don't use the national dialogue word. He's using it for sure, but I can say that it's just propaganda dialogue.
In fact, talking about this national dialogue, I recently heard an opinion from an Egyptian political dissident living, of course, outside Egypt. I'd like to share it with you and my listeners. He said, in a democratic country, governments do not call their citizens for a dialogue. Anyone can speak up, and if they don't like the authorities, citizens can vote them out. Do you agree?
It's very clear. It's very clear.
Yes. And just to put again the notion of the national dialogue, we could mention that Sisi started this tune in 2017 with a big international conference called the Youth Conference, and he held it in the resort area of Sharm el-Sheikh. Now, he has given the title in English, actually, because this was for the international community, not for Egyptians. He called it Let Us Talk. And reportedly, there were 45 sessions, all of them devoted to fighting imaginary terrorism, terrorists in Egypt. And only one session was devoted to the role of the media in a democratic country. So from 2017 up till now, Mohammed Kamel, do you think anything has changed?
Yes, to the worst, that's for sure. To the worst, but there's no doubt about this. Media situation is worse than before. Even what they call terrorism situation in Sinai is worse than before. The whole infrastructure is worse than before. People's daily life is worse than before. People now cannot pay for their essential needs to survive day by day. Food, not speaking about clothing, about medical aid, not about schools, education, not about transportation. They can't even, most of the Egyptians cannot even pay for food. But for sure, there is a class of citizens who is being enriched more by the corruption taking place in Egypt, which is, to the need, the corruption, there is really a huge factor in what's going on in Egypt, but it's a corruption being directed and managed by the authority and the top politician who's taking control of Egypt with Sisi as well.
I don't want to say that I fully agree with you, but, you know, the government, our government here in Canada, doesn't seem to agree. So just looking back at my notes from the time of Rabah, I'm going to quote here what the foreign minister, John Baird, said at the time. So he said that he was deeply concerned by the situation while calling on Egypt to implement reforms to ease tensions. He also said that Canada's stand is that Egypt should have a transparent democratic system and encourages and respects civil society and all the segments of Egyptian society. And here I quote, we urge both parties to avoid violence and engage in a meaningful political dialogue for the good of all Egyptians. All Egyptians should show restraint and resolve in the coming days. Now, what makes it really worse is that just dated August 16 of this year, Minister Sajjan concluded a trip to Egypt and announced intention to contribute $10 million for climate finance initiative. What do you think, Mr. Mohammed Kamel?
I have a big problem about two things here. The number one is, with all respect to John Baird, and he was a very, really respectful person, he used the anti-slogan when he put this statement, because this statement carried nothing related to reality, what's going on in Egypt at that day, because there is no two parties fighting. There was an elected government overthrown by an army who used force to overthrow them and then kill their supporter and imprison. Today became close to 100,000 persons, of not even of their supporter, but of any dissident from the government voice. So that's number one. Number two, to the current situation today, there is a huge mistake happened on the world arena by trying to buy the support of those dictators by buying in and going on in their field and playing with them the same game. So as an example, the environment conference planned to take place in Egypt this year. The minister visit to Egypt and put money on the environment in Egypt. I have no idea how Canada can justify to us, Canadians, that they putting money in the right place. They do not put money in the right place. They go to sleep in a bed with the dictator who kill his own people. They go supporting this continuity of borrowing money that nobody can aid. Forget this aid. This 10 million is aid. It's not a loan, but at least it's spending money on unnecessary stuff. And the situation, environment situation in Egypt is number, I don't say number, it is not listed on the priority of this regime in Egypt. So what Canada doing is really not helping Egyptian, not helping Canadian, even Canadian principles and values by supporting dictatorship. And this is actually is disgrace and is not really acceptable at all from the Canadian government. First, to visit Egypt without bringing the democracy issue to the table, the human rights issue on the table, where hundreds of people died in the prison and on the police station because of negligence and torture, for sure. And then we just do business as usual. It's not acceptable. It's actually what the minister did and what the Canadian government did today is not at all not representing the Canadian value at all.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Mohamed Kamil, for this interview. Please stay with us. This is CKUT 90.3 FM on the dial, and our program today focuses on the commemoration of the Rabah massacre that took place in Egypt in August 14, 2013. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM on the dial or www.ckut.ca on the internet. Today we present a special commemoration edition for the Rabah massacre that took place in Rabah Square, Egypt, August 2013. To put things in context, let's go back to January 25, 2011, Tahrir Square, the epicenter of the protest against President Hosni Mubarak. The winds of the Arab Spring that started in Tunisia were now blowing all over Egypt, and Saudis were demanding bread, liberty, social justice. Ultimately, Mubarak resigned, and subsequently, the late Mohamed Morsi was elected as president in June 2012. However, exactly 1 year later, Morsi was forcibly removed from office in a military coup orchestrated by the army general, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Over the course of the following 2 months, Mohamed Morsi's supporters, mainly but not exclusively from the Muslim Brotherhood Party, organized 2 large sit-ins in Cairo and smaller protests across Egypt to denounce the military takeover and demand the reinstatement of Morsi. In response, police and army forces repeatedly opened fire on demonstrators, killing over 1,000, most of them in 5 separate incidents of mass protester killings. Human Rights Watch 1 year investigation into the conduct of security forces in responding to those demonstrations indicate that police and army forces systematically and intentionally use excessive lethal force in their policing, resulting in killings of protesters on a scale unprecedented in Egypt. On the line with us, we have now Asma Ali Hussein, who actually was affected from this tragedy right after Rabah. Asma, welcome to our show, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Sana.
Asma, you are featured in the documentary Canadians for Rabah.
Sure. So,
and although I know it's very painful for you, but would you like to share with our listeners?
My husband and I, and our 9-month-old daughter at the time. So we had just traveled to Egypt to visit my husband's parents because they hadn't met our daughter yet. And that's kind of when all the rumblings were happening of the protests and such. And before we went, we really had no idea what was going on. So August 14th came, and the Rabah massacre happened, and my husband was a very principled man, and it was very, very difficult. It was a very difficult experience for him because we were in Alexandria at the time, and just to watch, you know, people on social media, you know, posting videos and images of what was happening was very, very difficult on him. And so 2 days later, August 16th, he went out to a protest in Alexandria, and that was to protest the mass murder of all of these peaceful protesters. And I remember calling him on the day of just to, you know, check on him and make sure he was okay. And he said, yeah, everything is fine. This protest has thousands of people and families, kids. Don't worry about me. I'll be home soon. And then about 30 to 40 minutes later, I got a phone call from his phone, but it wasn't him. And honestly, a big part of this is a blur in my head because it was so shocking and it happened so quickly. But basically, this person on the phone said that Amr had been shot and that someone needed to come collect his body. And obviously, I wasn't in the States, so Egypt is not really my home country per se. I was born and raised in Canada. So it was Amr's dad that went out and looked for him. And he did find him in a mosque there. And that's where they carried all the people who had been shot. It's interesting because they had a system, you know, that anybody who was shot, they would be taken to a specific place, and their items, their wallet, their, you know, wedding rings, all of those things would be held onto by someone so they could be passed on to family members. I mean, I always thought that the fact they had a system was really disturbing because they knew that the possibility of these things was always there. So that was in 2013. I personally have not been back to Egypt since then. I've written a lot about the situation. I appeared in the documentary Canadians of Rabat. And my assumption is that it's potentially not safe for me to go. I might be viewed as a dissident or whatnot and have some issues. But the years after that, you know, have been interesting, have been quite an emotional struggle for me.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go back to that moment where you were collecting your husband from the morgue because we know that the police would not allow families to retrieve bodies unless they signed a paper that their loved ones committed suicide, even if they had bullets in their bodies. So what was the reason of death that you had to write for on your husband's death certificate?
So it was actually not dealt with by me personally. So Amr's brother and his dad, they're both doctors, very well-known doctors in Alexandria. Excuse me. And so they went and they insisted upon writing, like getting his death certificate. And I'm not sure until today what the reason, the cause of death was, or even if there is a cause of death written. I know it's definitely not suicide. They refused to, like Amr's brother and dad, they refused to...
To sign
yeah. Something that said that, even though that's what they were being pushed towards. I think because they had some connections, they were able to get past that. But then also note that this was in Alexandria and not in Cairo. And I think like the number of people who were shot in Alexandria was lower. I mean, obviously it was still too high. It was over 40 people that day, 40, 45 people.
And this was after Rabat. It was not an encampment. It was a demonstration to protest what happened in Rabat. So.
Yes, exactly. So it wasn't a sit-in. It was just a demonstration. So what they would do is they would pray Friday prayers. And then the people would leave from Friday prayers and join the demonstration, and they would walk.
And you did mention, Asma, that your husband was specifically targeted because he looked Muslim. I mean, he had a beard, and this is why the sniper really targeted him.
So this is kind of a well-known fact. I don't know about Rabat, but I know that in Alexandria, they were specifically targeting people who looked more quote-unquote Muslim. You know, whatever that means, you know, like if they had a longer beard or if they were a little bit bigger, because, you know, my husband was tall and big, you know. And so we had reports that they were specifically targeting people who were of that build and who had that look of strength in them, which is very... There are a lot of things I can say about that, but those are the reports that we heard, yeah.
Now, moving forward, Asma, you were able to overcome your trauma and appear in the documentary and talk about what you've been through. Do you mind sharing it with our listeners?
Speaking about it is always very difficult, especially on camera. You know, this interview is almost a little bit easier because it's over the phone. You know, it's just voice. But on camera, there's a whole other dynamic. And I tend to, sometimes I get emotional when I speak about this, but I had to really kind of keep it together for the camera, which was a whole other challenge. But for me, my motivations to appear in the documentary were really one. My husband passed away in pursuit of telling the truth, you know, speaking truth to power, holding accountable people who had committed, you know, an atrocious crime. And to me, that's one of the highest levels of sacrifice that a person can make in his life, in his or her life. And while I'm here, I'm back in Canada in the safety of my home, the safety of my family, my community, I can still do what he did, obviously in a much smaller degree, but I can sit in front of that camera, and no matter how hard it is to speak those words, I speak them because he taught me to do that. He taught me the importance of speaking the truth and showing what actually happened to people. And that's my motivation of being in the documentary. And honestly, I'm really proud. I'm really proud of him, and I'm proud of myself that I was able to,
Absolutely, be in it. Absolutely. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. Now, what about your daughter? Does she ask you, where is daddy? What do you say to her?
So she's been asking me since she was very young, since she was maybe a year and a half, 2 years old. And I my response to her has always been, he's in Jannah or he's in paradise, you know, and he's waiting for us. And one day we're going to see him again. And, you know, that kind of general statement that a child might be able to understand, you know, conceptually. So she didn't find out until probably a year or two ago that he was shot, you know, because I didn't want to tell her. I didn't think it was age appropriate for her. And I also didn't want her to develop that fear. And so it's been a little bit of a journey on that, actually. But till now, she doesn't know 100% of the story, but she does know that he was shot, and she does know it was in Egypt. So it's still something that I'm working on.
She's 10 years old now, right, Asma?
Yes, she's about to be 10 years old.
And how about you? Did you contact any support group? I know for widows, there's always a suggestion that you should get together with like-minded women and maybe share your experience. Have you thought of that?
So over the years, I have connected with people over social media. Because I would post very openly about what my experiences were, what my challenges were, my grief. I spoke and wrote very openly about it. And so I would be contacted often by other widows, you know, some widows who were also widowed on that day in Alexandria, and then some from Rabat, and then some, you know, from many other countries. And so we did keep in touch. And until now, I actually do keep in touch with many of them, just on a personal level. In terms of a support group, I probably should have, but I didn't. But I do want to say that I'm currently in therapy, and I like saying that. I like, you know, telling people that, because I think it's important to normalize seeking help when you need it. And so it is a process that I'm still kind of working through, and there shouldn't be any taboo about that.
You're very courageous. Now, I know that you also write books. So tell us how writing has been part of the healing.
So writing is known to be something that's very therapeutic. When you write about your experiences, the good and the bad, you know, it's almost like a little valve that opens up and it lets the pressure out. Because when you don't have a way to let the pressure out, it just builds up inside of you. And that can become very unhealthy, even physically. It can manifest as, you know, disease at some point or another. Writing is a way, and people have other methods, right? Writing isn't the only way. But for me, I am a writer and I've always loved writing. So for me, it was a way to kind of release some of that pressure. Seeing words written on a page and being able to edit them and move them around and make them make sense also helped me emotionally and mentally get to a place where I thought, okay, this makes sense. Just that process of having something in your chest and then letting it out physically onto a page, it really lightens the spirit. And I like to make that a practice of mine, that regular journaling, really expressing what's going on inside.
Esma, would you like to read for us any extract of your book? You've done this so beautifully in the documentary. And again, you're not on camera, so perhaps this would be easier this time.
Yes, yeah, so there's actually an excerpt that it's one of my favorite excerpts from the book. I've posted it on social media a couple of times, and I will share it. So the title, I have two books. The title of the first, the one that's in the documentary, is A Temporary Gift, Reflections on Love, Loss, and Healing. The second book, published about 2 years ago, is called A Place of Refuge. When God decrees that a door in your life is to be opened, no matter how hard you try to close it, no matter how far you run away from it, it will remain open until you walk through it. When God decrees that a door is to be closed, no matter how many times you knock on that door, try to break it down, or cry on your knees in front of it, begging it to open again, it will never be opened. Grieve in front of the closed door if you must. Stand there for a time and look at it. Memorize its shape, its lines, its indentations. Hold your hands over your heart and press down to calm its quickened, pained rhythm. Then know beyond the shadow of a doubt, know in your heart of hearts that when you trust God and walk forward, he will open a more beautiful door for you. You will walk through it, and perhaps you will even praise him for having closed the past door you loved so much. He is Al-Fattah, the opener. May the doors he opened for us always lead us back to him.
Thank you very much, Esma. This is all what our time allows us today. Thank you for your courage, and thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
So thank you very much for joining us here on Amandla. Before we sign off, for those of you who'd be interested in learning more about Mohammed Dawood's film, he's also looking for some financial support and support in other ways, please do check it out on his website, which is www.warsha.ca, www.warsha.ca. And as for Asma Ali Hussein's two books, the titles are A Temporary Gift, Reflections on Love, Loss, and Healing. And the second book is A Place of Refuge. And both of those are available at amazon.ca.
So, ladies and gentlemen, this has been Amandla Radio here at CQT 90.3 FM. Stay tuned to Jazz Euphoria.
We're going to end this hour now with the soundtrack of a revolution, the music that inspired protesters who today brought down Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Elizabeth Blair has their story.
Perhaps the most popular song of the Egyptian Revolution is by Mohamed Mounir, a singer who is so revered he's known as the voice of Egypt.
MTL versus racism. Montreal versus racism.
MTL versus racism.
A concert united against racism and discrimination.
Un concert uni contre racisme et la discrimination.
Saturday, the 10th of September, 6 to 10 p.m. in Girouard Park.
Samedi, le 10 septembre, 18h à 22h à Parc Girouard indiqué.
Avec des performances de
Jonathan Emile,
Shawit,
Maritza,
Remy Picasso,
Paul Carniello,
DJ Lady Oracle.
Collecte de fonds pour Résilience Montréal.
Raising money for Resilience Montreal.
Tout le monde et tous les âges sont bienvenus.
Everybody is welcome.
This is a CKUT co-presentation.
you are listening to see, I can see it. CKUT in Montreal.
MuTech Montreal, the most important festival for digital creativity and electronic music in North America, returns for its 23rd edition at Quartier de Spectacle. From Tuesday, August 23rd to Sunday, August 28th, vibe to the rhythm of more than 100 local and international artists such as Caterina Barbieri, Cora Novoa, Koreatown Acid, Luke Slater, Max Cooper, and Nicola Cruz. MuTech also has a program dedicated to professionals with its MuTech Forum and Market, which consists of 4 days of exchanges and events centered around digital creation. The complete program and tickets are now available at a preferential rate at montreal.mutech.org. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Welcome to Amiri's Green Chim Chim Knees Growth Tribe.